was an insider, the ultimate insider, not just someone who has the ear of powerful people inside the royal court, but someone who was working closely with Saudi intelligence and was at this nexus of like the CIA in Saudi Arabia and Islamists, not just in Afghanistan, but in the decades afterwards throughout the region. So he knew things that would be incredibly damaging to the royal family and to the U.S.-Saudi relationship.
And Lawrence Wright, we have 30 seconds. MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, was hailed as a reformer in the U.S. when he came and met all of these important people across every industry. You yourself believed he was a reformer. What made you change your mind?
My last conversation with Jamal, I was asking him about that. And, you know, the thing that Jamal told me is that, you know, there's no room for anyone else's voice. And, you know, like the women who wanted to drive, he's granted them driving, but he's locked up the women that proposed it and tortured them. So the message that's gone out from those actions is, I'll do the deciding here. Nobody else has a voice in this kingdom except for me.
And at the end, after Jamal Khashoggi was murdered and President Trump was asked about this, when the CIA director said it was clearly from orders from the top, President Trump's response was, America first. He was not going to change his support of the Saudi regime. I want to thank Rick Rowley, director of Kingdom of Silence, and Lawrence Wright. We will do a post-show with Lawrence Wright.
You are tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, the Proud Boys are again making headlines, days after their Portland rally drew far fewer supporters than they expected. A new report shows serious concerns about investigations of local police shootings, and why a Supreme Court ruling is making it tougher to vote for some Native Americans. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 1st, 2020. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Demonstrators gathered to honor a man Portland police killed in 2018. Patrick Kimmons was 27 years old. A grand jury ruled the officers involved in shooting him 9 times were justified in using deadly force. Hundreds of demonstrators gathered in downtown Portland last night to mark the 2 years since his death and to demand justice. The group started at Pioneer Courthouse Square and marched to Southwest 3rd Avenue and Harvey Milk Street, where Kimmons, a black man, was fatally shot. The protesters shouted Kimmons' name, lit candles, and painted his name on the street. Officers say he pointed a gun at them. A new report finds Portland police trainers vouch for officers involved in fatal shootings at grand juries without knowing all the facts. The city hired consultants who found the Portland police training instructors stepped out of their lanes to vouch for officers in fatal shootings, even though they had only a passing familiarity with the facts, according to Oregon Live. The consultants also said they had questions about Portland State University officers and medics from the Fire and Rescue Bureau and AMR ambulance who ignored or defied requests to answer questions about the death of 52-year-old Richard Berry in police custody in 2018. The OIR group, which is based in California, looked at the training officers' testimony before grand juries that reviewed 6 Portland police shootings and 1 death in custody from 2017 and 2018. The Proud Boys rally in Portland's Delta Park last weekend drew a few hundred supporters after the group estimated they'd have an event bringing thousands to the Rose City. Now, a local Republican congresswoman and civil rights groups are criticizing President Trump's Proud Boys comments at the presidential debate. Southwest Washington Representative Jamie Herrera Butler tweets that the debate was, quote, the worst I've ever seen. She says all of us must reject white supremacy in all its forms and violence by anyone for any reason. The president needs to clarify his remarks immediately. This comes after a Proud Boys leader repeated Trump's call for people to show up at polling places and monitor the vote. Suzanne Potter has the story.
Civil rights groups are criticizing President Trump's remarks at Tuesday night's debate, where he called on the right-wing group Proud Boys to stand back and stand by. Yesterday, he amended that to stand down, but the group, which has been involved in violent confrontations at anti-racism rallies, welcomed the shout-out. Melvin Medina with the ACLU Connecticut says the president's initial comments were extremely divisive.
Donald Trump, he's touting the line of law and order, and I think he has weaponized the rhetoric around law and order to be targeted against a movement that values black life.
The Proud Boys posted ecstatic responses on social media and began raising money off it by selling T-shirts emblazoned with the president's words. But late Wednesday, Amazon stopped selling merchandise with the stand back and stand by message. The Proud Boys deny ties to white nationalism and self-identify as Western chauvinists. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which tracks hate groups, says Proud Boys do have a presence in the Nutmeg State. Medina notes that last year, a police officer in East Hampton retired early and resigned from the Proud Boys after it was revealed he was a dues-paying member of the group.
His reasoning for leaving the Proud Boys membership was because he believed that the Proud Boys would be attacked by the left wing, and not recognizing that actually the Proud Boys espouse an ideology that is harmful and hateful.
A 2001 report on extremism in Connecticut found a small presence of other extremist groups, including the Klan, the World Church of the Creator, the Council of Conservative Citizens, and the National Alliance. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler has loaned his re-election campaign $150,000. With Portland's campaign finance limits taking effect, the donation is causing some outcry among critics of the mayor. His election opponent, Sarah Iannarone, is calling the loan a blatant violation of the city charter and election laws that Portlanders voted to adopt. She accuses Wheeler of trying to buy the election with his inheritance. A majority of voters approved campaign finance limits in 2018, limiting individual donations to $500 and only letting candidates give themselves $5,000. But after court challenges back in April, the city auditor's office said that they would not enforce the measure limiting how much a candidate can fund their own campaign. Wheeler's campaign manager is defending the loan, saying self-funding saves time and tax money. The mayor is not taking part in the city's publicly funded election program, in which city money matches small dollar donations 6-1. Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty announced Wednesday she no longer supports Mayor Wheeler's re-election campaign, citing his record on police violence as the reason. Hardesty endorsed the mayor in the May primary, where Wheeler received just under 50% of votes, sending the election to a runoff in November. In remarks to the Oregonian, Hardesty commended Wheeler's response to the COVID crisis, but said, quote, because of his non-response around the police violence that has been happening, I just cannot, in good conscience, support him, end of quote. Wheeler and Hardesty repeatedly clashed on the issue of police violence and accountability this summer, with Hardesty calling on Wheeler to place the Portland Police Bureau under her charge. Wheeler serves as police commissioner and has refused to accept Hardesty's request. Wheeler's opponent, urban policy consultant Sarah Iannarone, promises to place Hardesty in the police commissioner role if she's elected. Commissioner Hardesty says she will not endorse anyone in the November mayoral race. Yesterday, she renewed her endorsement of City Commissioner Chloe Udaly's runoff re-election campaign. Hardesty's was the only position out of five city council seats not to open in the 2020 election cycle. A group is seeking a hearing about an alleged constitutional failure at the Bureau of Land Management. William Perry Pendler is now deputy director of the Bureau of Land Management after a federal judge ordered him to step down as acting director. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Defenders of public lands want a hearing in Congress on why William Perry Pendley remained so long as acting director of the Bureau of Land Management without U.S. Senate approval. On Friday, a federal judge forced Pendley to step down, but he remains at the agency as deputy director, and the Interior Department has said it will challenge the ruling. Aaron Murphy with Montana Conservation Voters has sent a letter on behalf of his group asking Senator Steve Daines to hold a Senate oversight hearing to examine what went wrong.
You think your United States Senator, who claims he's a conservation champion, would stand up and say, wait a second, this is wrong. Of course, Mr. Daines refuses to do that because he, like so many others, would rather not upset President Trump.
Daines' office has not yet responded to the letter or to a request for comment. This summer, President Donald Trump formally nominated Penley, but withdrew the nomination a few weeks later. Governor Steve Bullock sued the Interior Department, claiming Pendley's service was unconstitutional, and a federal judge agreed. Bullock is now challenging Daines for his Senate seat this November. Murphy says conservation groups opposed Pendley's nomination from the start because he's a former oil and gas attorney who has long supported the sale of public lands.
We have long maintained that zealot who opposes public land as much as William Perry Penley has done in the past has no place being in a position in control of millions of acres of land owned by all of us.
Federal law states that no agency head can serve in an acting capacity longer than 210 days. Penley was at the helm of the BLM for more than 400 days. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Trump administration has capped the number of refugees it will accept into the United States at 15,000 over the next year. The Washington Post reports that is an historic low. Refugee advocacy groups and Democrats are criticizing the decision. The State Department sent its notification to Congress late Wednesday, hours before the start of the government's 2021 fiscal year today. Since March, the number of refugees admitted to the United States has fallen sharply as the COVID-19 outbreak slashed global travel. Fewer than 12,000 refugees have arrived in the U.S. in the past year. Fewer new citizens will be able to vote. That will be the result of a federal government decision to wait on letting people take their oaths as new citizens. Nadia Ramlagan reports this comes even though the U.S. says it naturalized 834,000 new citizens in 2019, which was an 11-year high.
A federal agency's decision to postpone naturalization ceremonies due to COVID-19 will likely mean hundreds of thousands of people won't be able to vote in the November election. And critics of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency say the move can't be viewed in isolation. Legal director at the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition, Mary Catherine Harcombe, says even before the pandemic, wait times for citizenship applications have gotten longer. She believes the agency could have readily implemented virtual or socially distanced oath ceremonies, the final step in the naturalization process, rather than shutting them down.
So it's not just something bad that has happened because of the pandemic. It is sort of the culmination of what has seemed almost like a campaign to discourage people from naturalizing by making the process slower and slower and slower.
So far, the agency hasn't released a plan for resuming ceremonies, and it's unclear how many people are waiting to take their citizenship oaths. According to agency data, USCIS completed around 156,000 naturalizations between March and August. A Pew Research Center study found an estimated 23 million naturalized citizens would be eligible to vote in November. However, Harcombe notes those who haven't yet completed the process have had their hopes dashed.
The fact that they have taken every step and did so in a timely manner, only to now be told that this final little step, just this swearing-in ceremony, could prevent them from voting in this election, is just devastating for them.
Harcombe also points out the agency has, in the past few years, implemented more measures aimed at making citizenship harder to obtain.
USCIS is traditionally not partisan. USCIS is not involved in enforcement. They aren't involved in any of sort of the harsher aspects. In the last 4 years, USCIS has really shifted its focus and its attitude.
The agency has also announced rate hikes that nearly double the cost of becoming a citizen. As of October 2nd, Harcombe says it will cost a person almost $1,200 just to file the application. However, a federal court has temporarily blocked the massive fee hike. Dozens of fees related to the immigration process are slated to increase as well. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
You are listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio at 6, then at 8, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, clear skies with an overnight low of 53. And tomorrow, it'll be sunny and 85. Today in history, on this date in 1901, Henry Ford rolled out the Model T, designed to be an affordable car for the masses. Our quote of the day is from Henry Ford, who said, "When everything seems to be going against you, remember that the airplane takes off against the wind, not with it." Some experts are concerned about white supremacist violence leading up to the election. And the Presidential Debate Commission says it plans to change the rules after President Trump's almost constant interruptions during the first debate. With more on these stories, here's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
And that's where the danger is. When white supremacist ideas get to be seen as more mainstream and acceptable, when our president says stand by, that makes them seem acceptable as opposed to detestable.
Kenneth Stern with the Bard College Center for the Study of Hate says the far-right militant group Proud Boys took President Trump's debate mention as a shout-out, a stamp of approval. Yesterday, the memes were on T-shirts and related merchandise through Amazon and other online retailers until the stores pulled the items. Online analysts reported a major increase in far-right traffic on less moderated platforms where extremist comments aren't banned as often. Like Stern, Cassie Miller is also alarmed. She's an expert on hate groups with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
There is a real possibility that we could get far-right groups going out to polling places, to ballot boxes, and engaging in voter suppression or intimidation.
The Proud Boys was founded by British-Canadian Gavin McInnes, who also helped launch Vice Media. McInnes sued the Southern Poverty Law Center for labeling the Proud Boys a, quote, hate group. McInnes has since disavowed the organization. The only Black Republican in the Senate, Tim Scott, said yesterday that white supremacy should always be condemned, but the president simply, quote, misspoke and should clarify his statement. Other GOP lawmakers agreed with Scott. Trump tried to walk it back, saying he doesn't know who the Proud Boys are, but again quickly pivoted to condemning far-left violence, even though national security agencies consistently report more violence committed by far-right extremist groups. Elections officials and experts say the pandemic will make this an election season, and media outlets won't be able to make the quick calls they normally do. But the actual certification process doesn't change. That period right after the election, when the public is used to quick calls, is what concerns Kenneth Stern from Bard.
Trump has made very clear that he's going to say that this was rigged. He's encouraging people to sort of watch the polls and so forth. I really worry that we're going to see, if not violence, potential for violence and certainly vilification and bullying around the time of the election and in the immediate aftermath.
Yesterday, the Presidential Debate Commission said they'd change the rules for future debates, quote, to ensure a more orderly discussion of the issues.
Trump more consistently, as Chris Wallace was pointing out, was interrupting Biden and not following the guidelines he was given, that the candidates were given and agreed to.
Robert Yoon, a visiting professor at the University of Michigan, who's helped prepare moderators for more than 30 debates, thinks that's partly just Trump's style, but that different rules could help.
Having one person talk for 2 minutes and then the other person talk for 2 minutes and then moving on doesn't give a lot of the back and forth that some of these issues kind of require.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks to Suzanne Potter from New Hampshire News Service, and thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
An internal document from the Department of Homeland Security shows officials were directed to speak favorably about Kenosha shooter Kyle Rittenhouse. The 17-year-old from Antioch, Illinois, faces charges for the fatal shootings of two people and the wounding of a third at a protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin in August. He is also charged with endangerment and illegal possession of a firearm. The document obtained by NBC News lists suggested media talking points for DHS officials to use when discussing Rittenhouse, despite the ongoing investigation. NBC's Julia Ainsley, who broke the story late last night, emphasizes that any comments on an ongoing investigation are outside the norm for law enforcement officials. Many of the comments reflect President Trump's own sympathetic statements, including a push to paint the shooter as acting in self-defense and in defense of Kenosha small businesses. Leaders of Native organizations say COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc on tribes. U.S. Attorney General William Barr hosts a roundtable at Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi signs the Not Invisible Act and Savannah's Act. With those stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Leaders of the National Congress of American Indians, the National Indian Health Board, and the National Council of Urban Indian Health testified in a House Appropriations Subcommittee Wednesday that COVID-19 continues to wreak havoc on tribes. They urged lawmakers to ensure tribes are included in COVID-19 emergency response funding packages with flexible spending options. They also say accurate federal data collection is needed for allocations to meet tribal needs and for Indian Country programs to be fully funded. Francis Crevier, CEO of the National Council of Urban Indian Health, says the severity of COVID-19 is impacting the Indian Health Service.
The pandemic will not wait for an election, and Congress can't wait either. It is the obligation of the government to provide these resources to Indian Country. As our allies, we urge this committee to impress upon your colleagues the urgency of meeting this obligation, as full funding would aid in eradicating centuries of systemic oppression that has led to this pandemic impacting Indian Country significantly more than it would have had IHS been fully funded.
Leaders of the national organization say chronic underfunding of programs and the federal government's neglect has exposed the vulnerabilities in tribal communities having high COVID-19 infection rates. A recent Center for Disease Control and Prevention study found in 23 selected states, COVID-19 cases among American Indians and Alaska Natives were 3.5 times higher than whites. Meanwhile, this week, lawmakers are working to pass another relief package. On Wednesday, U.S. Attorney William Barr visited the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma to lead a roundtable discussion with Cherokee Nation leaders and two U.S. attorneys. Barr, in opening comments, says he's made Indian Country a priority in the Justice Department and says the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision McGirt is on everyone's mind, which affirmed Muscogee Creek Reservation, leading to tribal, state, and federal jurisdiction questions. Barr also announced nearly $300 million in Justice Department tribal grants to improve public safety and assist crime victims to support law enforcement COVID-19 assistance and youth programs across the country.
This funding will be almost $40 million allocated to Oklahoma and over $7.6 million directly to the Cherokee Nation.
Barr's remarks touched on the Trump administration's Operation Lady Justice to address missing and murdered Indigenous people, which he says is working on action plans and protocols. On Wednesday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi signed the Not Invisible Act and Savannah's Act, which address missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. The Not Invisible Act creates an advisory committee on violent crime to make recommendations to federal agencies. Savannah's Act creates new guidelines for responding to cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Congresswomen Deb Haaland and Norma Torres joined Pelosi for the signing and are advocating for the bills to become law. The Institute of American Indian Arts celebrated the retirement of Academic Dean Charlene Teeters. Teeters, an artist, educator, and advocate, is well known for her work on Indian mascots. During an outdoor ceremony Wednesday in Santa Fe, New Mexico, Teeters expressed her appreciation for the institution as a student in the 1980s and then as an educator, which she says was a dream come true to teach Native people.
I love my people. I love my AIA.
The IAIA community thanked her for being a role model and credited her activism for helping in the movement to eliminate Indian mascots in the United States. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A 2013 U.S. Supreme Court ruling gutted key parts of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. As Roz Brown reports, that allowed new laws that make it more difficult to vote in Indian Country.
This year's coronavirus pandemic has made it more difficult for many Americans to vote in the November 3rd election. But voting obstacles are not new for those living in Indian country. Native American reservations have what's called non-standard mail service, which means they don't have mailboxes or receive residential mail delivery and instead travel to a postal provider office, sometimes a gas station or mini mart. In addition, Jacqueline DeLeon with the Native American Rights Fund says Indigenous people live much farther from polling locations than non-natives.
It's much more difficult than the average American can conceive of to vote in Indian country. Native Americans have a decrease in post office hours. They also have their ballots travel further.
DeLeon adds that fewer transportation options, a lack of internet access, and other socioeconomic factors also play a role in whether Indigenous people vote. She says it's not uncommon for Native Americans to travel up to 200 miles to register to vote or reach their polling place. In August, Nevada lawmakers expanded mail-in voter laws to address challenges posed by the COVID-19 pandemic. Assembly Bill 4 allows non-family members to safely return a ballot for one another in the upcoming election. It also provides mechanisms for tribes to request early on-reservation polling locations. DeLeon says prior to Nevada's vote-by-mail primary in June, more than 90% of the Indigenous population voted in person.
There's already a history here of unequal access. And then the tribes in this last primary election, which moved all to vote-by-mail, ended up having a decrease in turnout.
More than 52,000 people identify as Native Americans in Nevada. Earlier this month, a federal judge ruled Nevada can move forward with its new vote-by-mail law after rejecting a lawsuit filed by President Donald Trump's re-election campaign to stop it.
Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
For Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
Some groups across the western United States are calling for more wilderness protection, including for the Lewis and Clark National Forest, which covers more than 2.8 million acres of land. Mike Moen reports.
The process of developing a new management plan for a national forest in Montana enters its next phase this week. Those who object to certain decisions will get a chance to speak up in hopes of securing modifications. Last May, federal officials released their final draft of a revised management blueprint for the Helena, Lewis and Clark Forest, which features scenic vistas and a range of wildlife across 17 counties. Amy Robinson of the Montana Wilderness Association says while the group likes a lot of the plan, they believe some areas didn't receive enough wilderness protection.
The Big Snowies was recommended for wilderness about three-quarters of the area. We believe that area can be expanded. And then the Middle Fork Judith area actually was not recommended at all.
The purpose of a wilderness designation is to maintain these lands as untouched and wild as possible. Starting on Tuesday, the U.S. Forest Service will hear arguments from groups who have filed formal objections, with the possibility of a resolution between both sides. Those meetings, being held virtually, wrap up on Thursday. The plan is expected to be finalized in the coming months. One of the concerns over how certain areas are designated is that it might result in activities some feel aren't suited for pristine public lands. Sherry Leinberger of the Montana Backcountry Horsemen says even though some sections of the park are labeled primitive, the plan still allows the use of mountain bikes. She says that won't mix well with people hiking or horseback riding.
It changes the perception of the use of what we all think of as primitive, which is, you know, kind of the ancient old way of transportation.
Forest management plans also cover timber production, and the draft update says there are 119,000 fewer acres in Helena, Lewis and Clark that are suitable for such production when compared to the previous guidelines. These forests merged back in 2015 and had been operating under management plans last updated in the mid-1980s. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
You're listening to a fall membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Samantha Lau, Annette Newell, and Althea Billings. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and National Native News. Our evening news director is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I am Annette Newell. Stay tuned for KBOO News In-Depth, coming up next.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
There's an empty seat on the Multnomah County Circuit Court. Judge Gregory Silver is retiring after serving since 2013. In the May primary elections, six candidates ran to replace him. Two of these candidates have advanced to the general election. They are Rima Gondour and Adrian Brown. Whoever's elected will oversee both civil and criminal cases for the Multnomah County Circuit Court. Joining us today is candidate Rima Gondour. Rima grew up in the Lebanese Civil War and was displaced to Iraq. She came to the United States for college when she was 18. Rima now runs a private, woman-owned law firm in Portland, handling a variety of cases. She has 23 years of experience in both public and private law practice. Rima has won several awards, including the Oregon State Bar President's Diversity and Inclusion Award and the Richard M. Ginsburg Award for Outstanding Leadership for Immigrant Rights from the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Rima also co-founded the Arab American Cultural Center of Oregon, where she has served as president and is now a board member. If elected, Rima will become the first Muslim and Arab woman judge in Oregon. She's been endorsed by 25 judges, the National Lawyers Guild, 13 out of 14 unions in Multnomah County, and many minority community associations. Rima Gondour, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Brian, for having me here today.
You've spoken before about the importance of representation. How does being a circuit court judge factor into advancing racial justice?
Yes, Brian, representation is important because for us to have trust in the judicial system, we have to, the judges and the juries actually have to be representative of the people that they are serving. It's vital to have a perspective, different perspectives as a judge when you do your deliberations, and that will promote legitimacy of the court. And once you have an increased trust in the court, people will feel and know that they can come to the court and not worry about being prejudiced against because of race or religion or disability or any of the many wars we've been going through.
You lived through war and dictatorships in your early life. How does that inform your perspective on the importance of civil liberties?
Yeah, you know, growing up, civil liberties were rarely discussed. And in Iraq, there were very free speech is really important. Freedom of assembly is very, very important. Seeing the lack of what I consider basic rights growing up makes me a strong supporter and protector of our civil liberties. They're very important. They're what keeps the democracy going in the long term, and are important for everyday citizens to be able to live their fullest life.
Your opponent, Adrian Brown, is positioning herself as someone who holds the Portland Police Bureau accountable for their brutality. If you're elected, how will you address police brutality?
I will address police brutality case by case as it comes to me. I will make sure that there is no additional preferences in my courtroom regarding if the testimony is coming from a police officer versus a non-police officer citizen that's in the court. And it's frankly up to the DA whether they bring cases in or not. And if they do, I will make sure that my courtroom is as welcoming as possible for the patients and that everybody is treated equally in the courtroom.
When you spoke to us in May, you said you don't want people to be afraid of the legal system. How can the courts become more inclusive and accessible to vulnerable and marginalized communities in Multnomah County?
Yeah. Yeah, this is something that I've heard a lot from different community members that are afraid to come to the courts, afraid to bring legitimate righteous cases to the court because they really don't believe they can get a fair shake. So one way of combating that is having, I know you're saying the word representation, but it's having representation and having this representative of the different communities of color in the court, be out in the community, so that the community knows that they're there, knows that there is tolerance and inviting in of different people, different cultures, different abilities. So they know that they are welcome and their cases are going to be judged on the merits of the case. And that if there is any indication that there's anything else going on in the courtroom, the judge is going to call the parties to account for them.
Some of our most vulnerable people are the houseless and those without health care. Can a circuit court judge help to fix Multnomah County's income inequality?
Well, a circuit court judge will be hearing cases on which on wage theft. They will be hearing cases on landlord-tenant issues, all issues that affect income inequalities. So, again, depending on the case, but there is some influence there or some ability to fix the problem. The problem is when by the time things come to the court, they're already broken, right? So it's trying to make the best of what's something that's already broken.
Another issue our listeners are concerned about is climate change. What impact would your election have on the climate crisis?
Probably not much. We, as judges, we won't be able to, we don't legislate, right? Legislature, laws come from the legislature. There might be cases that are being brought in front of the judges, and those will have to be decided case by case.
Can you share with us a little bit about your volunteer work and civic experience outside of practicing law?
Yeah, so one of the things I do love, in, I love the RDG quote on it, that the things that mean the most to her was the work that she was not paid for. And to me, that is, I feel the same with that. I don't want to go through too many things, but at least in the legal community, I have spent years on the board of the Multnomah Bar Association and the Oregon Women Lawyers Multnomah Chapter. I became president of both organizations, and the whole idea during that time was to bring voices from the margins that have been asking and wanting to be heard and not being heard. And talking about some difficult issues, like, rape and sexual harassment in the workplace as lawyers. I've also worked with Oregon State Bar on diversity and equity issues for years. And one of my dear friends in my heart has been when I first came to Oregon, met some people and started the Arab American Cultural Center of Oregon with a bunch of them. And it's an organization where we try to bring culture understanding, try to get rid of stereotypes and get everybody to come together in a fun, loving way and enjoy each other's cultures and learn about each other. Those are some of the things I've done. I've also done DACA renewal and refugee readjustment. I'm not an immigration attorney, but I've volunteered a lot of work doing that to make sure our refugees and new immigrants and our dreamers are able to stay in the U.S.
Is there anything else that you would like our listeners to consider before November's election?
Yes. I mean, elections are important. We have national elections, which are very, very important. But a lot of change can happen at the local level. In judicial elections are one where people don't know who to vote for, and so they just don't fill in the bubble. I'd ask your listeners to actually go in, research it. The judges are the ones who are going to handle the most stressful part of your life, usually. And you want somebody there who has the compassion, the empathy, the lived experience to understand where you're coming from. So that's what I would leave them with. And please vote.
Rima, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thank you so much, Ryan, and you have a great evening.
In November's general election, voters will decide between Rima Gondour and Adrian Brown for seat 12 of the Multnomah County Circuit Court's 4th District. Election day is Tuesday, November 3rd. The Postal Service recommends mailing in your ballot at least a week in advance. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Brian Oster.
We are fortunate to sit down today with Adrian Brown, a candidate for Multnomah County Circuit Court Judge, District 4, Position 12. Adrian has been an assistant U.S. attorney in Oregon for the past 12 years and served as the department's civil rights coordinator. She has worked with cases involving the state's mental health system, Portland police practices, and accessibility. Before that, she worked for 7 years as an attorney in the U.S. Air Force, where she served as a counsel for Air Force personnel. Adrian, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
First, tell us a little about the responsibilities and obligations of a circuit court judge.
Sure. So it's a great question because many people don't know what a judge does and unless they've appeared in front of one or had to serve as counsel. And yet we're asking the public to make a decision in this race. So I think it's extremely important for people to understand that a circuit court judge, especially here in Multnomah County, which is the busiest circuit court docket in our state, is to serve as a generalist and be ready and prepared to take on cases as assigned by the presiding judge. And those cases are largely going to be cases involving criminal allegations and charges, as well as surrounding issues before a case goes to trial or after a case goes to trial on the criminal side. The cases also involve civil litigation, a variety of complex issues that may come before the courts that haven't been able to be resolved by the parties. And court is often a place of last resort, and that's true in civil and criminal cases. And in civil cases, you may hear everything from an employment discrimination case to a contract claim. They're the things that we're experiencing in everyday lives. And the court's the one that gets to hopefully help the parties move along and find justice in a very fair and impartial way.
And you currently work in the Civil Rights Division at the U.S. Attorney's Office. Can you tell us a little about some of the cases you've worked with there?
Yes, thank you. Yes, I not only work as the civil rights coordinator, I actually created that position. I created that position in about 2009 when I saw through the work of my own on actually a fair housing case that the department does this work and it wasn't embedded in our office as part of its structure. And I realized that one of the things that's so important is making sure that the community has a place here locally. I know Oregonians and Portlanders value that, I think, proudly a lot more than anywhere. And yet there wasn't a place here for that structure. So I built that office, I built that structure. And what that office entails is coordinating the cases that come into our office on civil rights issues of any kind. In the Civil Rights Division in Washington, D.C., there are 10 sections. And those sections each specialize in different areas of civil rights, such as the ADA or fair housing or policing. As a civil rights coordinator, I get the opportunity to work on all of those cases. And one of the most humbling cases of my career was indeed working on the Portland policing practices case that we brought in 2012. And that case stemmed from a lot of community concern across the board, from individuals, from advocacy organizations, even elected leaders, about the practices of our police, both in regard to how the police were handling excessive use of force, as well as just the policing and community trust divide. And I worked on that case for about 7 years, and I am proud of that work because it was humbling, and the amount of individuals that came forward to talk to us. So one of the first things we did was get out in the community and talk to individuals one-on-one. We interviewed well over 100 members, had listening sessions as well, and brought in feedback in all sorts of forms from the community. And then we also looked at the other parts of the system as well. So the other players that are involved, such as the specialty courts that the judges here in Multnomah County work on, such as mental health specialty courts and drug treatment courts, and talked to attorneys on both sides, both prosecutors and defense attorneys. And we also talked to the faith-based community as well. And we learned a lot about the trust divide. Leaders like Dr. Bethel and Dr. Haynes, who are head of the Albina Ministerial Alliance, really brought to light the decades of mistrust that was occurring and had never been resolved. And so through that work, we brought forward not just a constitutional finding on the problems and the issues involving police response and use of force, but also the community trust divide. And after 7 years on that case, I'm no longer working on that case because I decided to run to try to become a judge in our community, because I believe that's where the real difference can be made, is in the local community. And I am proud that I have the endorsement of everyone that I worked with in that case, on all sides of that case, because it really, I think, speaks to my interest not only in the community's work, but my temperament as well in listening to all sides.
That's a great point. I know judicial ethics prevent you from stating positions on certain issues, but as you yourself said, as an attorney, you made it clear you seek to hold the Portland Police Bureau accountable for its actions. How would your role in combating police brutality change if you were to become judge?
Sure. That's excellent question. I know it is top on your mind for your listeners and for really all of Portland and now even throughout the country. You know, the groundswell that occurred after the murder of George Floyd and countless names of others. I started doing this work long before that groundswell occurred, and I know there are many leaders in our community, such as Commissioner Hardesty and Dr. Haynes and Senator Avell Gordley and many, Kathleen Sadat, many others who are supporting me, who have been championing that work for decades. And while we are certainly grateful that there's now some traction because of the groundswell, the work really has been going on for a long time. And I think as a judge, the important thing that the unique experience that I can bring, which is the exact experience needed at this moment in time on the bench, is that ability to look at the system holistically. So while a judge must understand her role is not to be an advocate for either side, but it's at the same time, it's to make sure that justice happens in a fair and impartial manner. And what I mean by that is ensuring that you're able to see both sides and you're able to understand and know what has brought both sides to that moment. And the work that I've done is not just been in the community, but it's actually tackling these legal and policy issues. So part of my work in the policing case was working with policing experts to help draft new policies with the Portland Police. Now, my job as a judge is not going to be to draft policies, but I have a really technical expertise and understanding of policing practices as a result of my work on that case. And yet at the same time, I also understand the work of law enforcement. I have served as a prosecutor, prosecuting cases largely involving victims, person-on-person crimes, sexual abuse of children, domestic violence, rape, drug trafficking. And I also understand the work of law enforcement as well. I think one of the things that maybe the only thing, you know, that Ethan Knight and Mike Schmidt could agree on is that I should be judge. They're both endorsers of mine. And so I look forward to being able to bring that perspective of not just understanding both sides, but I've worked on both sides. I've worked as a defense counsel as well and represented individuals who have been, have had concerns definitely regarding techniques that were used by law enforcement in their investigations. So I think it's so important to, as a judge, to continue to be human and to see that humanity and that complexity on both sides. And it's not just through the social justice lens, it's also through your experience of practicing in court.
Adrian, before we wrap up, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners today?
I would just like to share, I'm very grateful for this opportunity. As someone who has worked in public service for the entirety of her career, many, many times, career public servants don't have an opportunity to shine the good work they do, because it's not about promoting yourself as a law firm or as a private individual or as a business. This is an opportunity to promote the good work that we do have in public service. And so I'm so honored to have been the top vote getter in the primary and to have this opportunity to help voters know a little bit more about who does make up your government, and that you do have people who want to do the right thing for the right reasons and act with courage, even in the face of very challenging times. So thank you to your supporters for being interested, and thank you for voting.
Adrian, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19. So let's get started.
The White House Task Force, it needs to stop hiding its weekly reports from the public. Now, the White House Coronavirus Task Force has been working since June to collect and archive some very detailed reporting on COVID-19 spread.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if the general public could actually read that reporting?
Yes.
We're talking about weekly reports delivered to the governors of each state and the District of Columbia. They'd include data on testing reports, prevalence assessments by each county, and even recommendations on how to fight the virus. But so far, the task force has declined to share these reports with the public. Most Americans only get to see them when there's a congressional inquiry or a news investigation or a leak by state or federal officials or dun-dun-dun breaking news.
Yes, reporters. We love investigative reporters. Now, previous leaks revealed which states were in the COVID-19 red zone, information that the task force and the White House are keeping under lock and key. There's a new nonpartisan project called the COVIDExitStrategy.org. The website tracks how each state is dealing with the virus.
Yeah, the project's founder wrote a column for statnews.com recently. He said these reports would help Americans see just how severe the pandemic really is. Remember, they're called, I'm doing air quotes, Doc, public records for a reason.
Yes, they are.
This information belongs to the public. And this project is doing the best it can to round up critical health data for the American public. Transparency is key. Doc, if there's no other time to be transparent, it's now.
That's exactly right. And I always love to quote President Barack Obama, who says that sunshine is the best disinfectant. It's a good COVID reference.
Only because you referenced it with President Barack Obama. I'm going to let that go.
It's a good reference. It's a COVID-19 thing there.
Yeah, okay. Older does equal wiser. You know, there's an African proverb that says, those who respect the elderly pave their own road toward success.
A new report in the Washington Post hints at the power of older people to accept diversities with grace. There's something about older generations that allow them to weather the pandemic, often much better than middle-aged and younger folks. Our elders tend to be more patient and tolerant of the fact that we cannot control everything in our lives.
Hey, you know, you don't get old being no fool.
That's right.
So
hi,
while,
Annie Mae.
So while, was that a Richard Pryor? Yeah.
Was it?
Yeah, so while mental health issues are on the rise during the pandemic, many of our elderly people seem to be adapting just fine. A study in the American Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry found that among seniors with pre-existing depression issues, there was no significant increase in anxiety and depression symptoms linked to COVID-19.
Now, that's amazing if you think about it, because younger generations might not have the experience or life skills to handle quarantines and long-term social isolation. Fortunately, many people are finding the time to get back in touch with older friends and relatives, especially when everyone can figure out how to use that video chat, Zoom / FaceTime / WhatsApp / whatever.
TikTok. So, you know, Doc, you know, being in the community, you'd be surprised how quickly some of the elderly are adapting to technology. They've learned to increase their contact with their friends. You know, they can be pretty obstinate.
I would imagine.
Yeah, you should know. You're their age. Yeah, that increased contact helps the young and old alike. And some groups are working on ways to expand social interaction amongst older adults through weekly conversations and postcards. And I even know some matriarchs of families in the community that are the host of regular Zoom meetings.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So I know that my father-in-law, his mother is 93, and we do regular Zoom calls with her as well. But what about younger generations that can learn from some of the seniors?
Well, what they need to do is learn to stay home.
Right.
So they can do those things. You don't get older. If you want to be a doctor, you hang out with doctors. If you want to be a policeman, you have a police person, you hang out with police people. If you want to be older, you hang out with
older individuals.
Exactly.
So does exposure to age diversity contribute to our longevity?
Absolutely, especially if it's by Zoom these days.
That's right. We love all of our older listeners. The new age of pandemic vacations. Quarantine fatigue has become a real issue for many of us after months and months of social isolation. Some of us might look for a little relief on the road or a vacation.
Yeah, but the problem is that COVID-19 is all over the place.
You're right.
We can't escape it.
You're right.
So a lot of your typical getaway destinations are under safety restrictions too. It's like a big group to New York or San Francisco just isn't what it used to be. Even hitting the beach feels a little uncomfortable when it gets overcrowded.
Have you been to the beach and is it overcrowded?
No, but I look at the pictures and they give me the heebie-jeebies, you know?
All right. Camping, though, offers a lot more elbow room. And glamping, what is glamping?
Dude, did you just say glamping?
Glamping. That's glamorous camping. I did not write these words.
That is Dr. Gary. He is a glamorous camper.
I did not write
these
words.
You are a glamorous camper. You have a blinged out tent.
Is seeing a surge in popularity.
I love it.
Some online rental services like Airbnb are offering everything from traditional campground cabins to the most decked out, elaborate glamping.
Air quotes.
Glamping sites you can imagine. I bet you glamp.
Oh, I glamp. I have all of the accoutrements of technology. Yes.
When it's a site near a big lake, so this is true. Actually, Leon and I've been doing this.
Yeah,
so when it's a site near a big lake or a mountain trail for hikers, a lot of people do find that there's a lot to be able to enjoy in terms of the great outdoors. But please, vacation safely in the meanwhile.
Does your cabin have Wi-Fi? Common question. But seriously, big nature attractions like Yellowstone National Park have seen an uptick in visitors. About 955,000
wow.
people visited
wow.
Yellowstone in July alone. Now, for some reason, that makes me nervous,
yeah.
Doc. Social distance, I guess. Big
but the
trees.
Park is big, though.
Yeah, I got it. Oof, but that's what I mean. It makes me nervous. And because the park is so big, those visitors can remain safely distanced. And in a space like that, it's easy to see.
Yeah.
But you have to be safe and respect nature because
that's
there
right.
are the inhabitants that are there.
Yes.
And they don't take kindly to unwanted neighbors. Chances are your home state probably has a long list of natural attractions, campsites, and other nice remote spots for enjoying nature.
That's right. And I've been telling Doc Griggs, you need to go do that.
Yeah, I need to glamp. I need to glamp.
You know, when I go to your place, it feels like I'm glamping.
No, I'm glamping. Cases of COVID-19 infection in Africa have been leveling off in recent months. And the director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is getting a lot of well-deserved credit for it.
In fact, CDC Director John Nakisong led an effort to bring Africa's 54 nations together as a united front against COVID-19, and it's paying off with some major declines.
The World Health Organization reported a 14% decrease in new cases and a 2% decrease in COVID cases in mid-September compared to the previous reporting period. Health officials say the continent's relatively younger population, the late arrival of the virus in Africa, and swift lockdowns all helped to keep Africa's rate of infection a bit lower than other continents.
Yeah, in fact, part of what the Africa CDC did was streamline access to proper medical supplies. Huh, imagine that. And that's been a struggle in many places around the world. Fixing that in Africa, now that was a game changer. And at the start of the pandemic, just two African countries were able to do adequate testing. Now the CDC says that testing capacity has spread across the continent.
Not the country, because it's not a country, but the entire continent, folks. Not a country, but the entire continent. Africa's public and private sectors worked together to create an online purchasing platform, which allowed health authorities to concentrate their negotiating power and buy directly from manufacturers, some of which are from Africa. They effectively built a new supply chain. The next major obstacle for Africa may be vaccinations, even when a vaccine has been finally tested and approved. Distributing it to the people who need it will be a huge challenge in the continent of Africa and everywhere else.
That's right. But African countries are already talking about equitable access and how best to manufacture and distribute any vaccine. The Africa CDC director says the continent needs at least 1.5 billion doses of vaccine. And that amount should be enough for two doses each for about at least 60% of the population. Doc Griggs, they're doing a great job in Africa, far better than what we've seen in other countries, let alone we have not seen this in other continents with 54 countries working together.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is here is that they have a CDC director for the entire continent.
That's actually a great point.
That's huge.
Yes.
It's top down at its finest. Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to Rose City Native Radio, Low Res Edition. We've got music and much more coming up for you. It's also a good time to remind you that you can help support community radio today by going to kboo.fm.